Welcome to the History of the Americans podcast, episode 146. I'm your host, Jack Henneman, and I'm recording this on, no foolin', April 1st, 2024, in Austin, Texas. We are telling the history of the lands now encompassed by the United States from the beginning without intentional presentism. It's been longer than I prefer since the last episode, and I very much appreciate your patience. I've had a very busy stretch in the struggle for the legal tender, but the delay is mostly because my muse decided I should do an overview of the English Civil Wars and the Commonwealth before continuing through the 1650s and 1660s. The Civil Wars have come up a few times, such as in our episode on Opechancanough's Last Stand, Opechancanough, and the series on The Plundering Time. But I read up on New Haven and Maryland, and I realized that I needed to learn more about the period in English history between roughly 1640 and the Stuart Restoration in 1660. And so here we are. It must be said up front that British listeners will no doubt find this overview tediously shallow and rife with rank generalizations and even error. Guilty as charged. The American analogy would be to cover the years between the run-up to our own Civil War and the Reconstruction of the South in one podcast episode. But this is the history of the Americans, so this overview, however shallow, will have to do for our purposes. Those who want more can go check out David Crowther's History of England podcast, which is going deep on the Civil Wars as I write these words. For the readers among you, I recommend Jonathan Healy's recent book, The Blazing World, A New History of Revolutionary England, which is a delight. A link in the show notes on the website, blah, blah, blah. In addition to Healy, my main source for this episode is decidedly not recent, but it is American. George Bancroft, who was the father of the history profession in the United States, wrote a multi-volume history of the United States from the discovery of the continent through the 18th century, the last edition of which came out in the 1870s. You've heard me quote him before. Bancroft devotes a couple of chapters to the English Civil Wars and the Commonwealth and their relation to English North America. His language is a bit dated, and his interpretation has no doubt been revised numerous times since, but Bancroft's characterization of the impact of that war on our own history strikes me as still respectable, at least for the purposes of this humble podcast. Long-standing and attentive listeners will recall the earliest roots of the revolutionary era in England from two of our episodes in early 2023, on the Rise of the Puritans, Parts 1 and 2. Those of you who are truly hardcore might want to listen to those again before this one. For those of you who are merely softcore, suffice it to say that under James I and Charles I in the 1620s, the Crown and the Parliament found themselves in profound disagreement over their respective powers and privileges. Those disagreements involved the circumstances under which the Crown could raise taxes without the consent of Parliament, and the extent to which the king could suppress dissent, in effect censor speech, in Parliament. In principle, that conflict had little to do with religion, but in practice, the Puritans, increasingly pressured by the crown and the hierarchy of the Church of England, lined up with the parliamentarians, and the old-school Anglicans sided with the crown. The crisis of the 1620s came to a head in March 1629, when Charles I suspended Parliament for more than a decade, a period that came to be known as his personal rule. It was during those years that the infamous Archbishop William Laud cracked down on Puritans to such a degree that tens of thousands of them left England for Ireland, the Caribbean, and New England. John Winthrop's fleet, the vanguard of the Puritan Great Migration to Massachusetts Bay, arrived in New England in 1630. More than 20,000 English followed Winthrop's original settlers during the 1630s. By the end of that decade, there were more than 30 English towns in the region divided among roughly seven colonies of varying legality and poorly defined borders. The biggest by far was the Massachusetts Bay Colony. Plymouth Colony had preceded it, and both of those original settlements had set up towns in Connecticut, which had become a colony in its own right. In 1636, Roger Williams had established the Providence Plantations and acquired the rights to Aquidneck Island, where Anne Hutchinson and her followers would settle in 1637. Then in 1638, John Davenport and Theophilus Eaton established a new colony in New Haven, which we'll tackle in very short order. Settlements in New Hampshire and today's Maine, both of which were ultimately annexed by Massachusetts, rounded out the main English presence north of the Chesapeake. Maryland and Virginia were, of course, very different places, but no less affected by the political drama in the mother country. The plundering time in Maryland was to some degree an extension of the English Civil War into the Chesapeake, and it may even be the case that Opechancanough started his last war in 1644 because he knew the English were at war with themselves. The 11 years of personal rule were reasonably orderly in England, in part because so many of those annoying Puritans left, but beneath the surface, social pressure intensified. Charles raised money by various controversial and arguably extra-legal means to pay his expenses, which increased considerably when the Scots rebelled in 1637 over his imposition of a new Book of Common Prayer that emphasized ceremony over scripture. By the spring of 1640, the war with the Scots had become very expensive, and Charles had run out of money. Resistance to new taxes not authorized by Parliament put him in a bind, so he called a new Parliament for the first time since 1629. Not surprisingly, the new Parliament insisted on its ancient prerogatives, and Charles quickly ended it, which is why history refers to it as the Short Parliament. This would turn out to be a mistake, for it would be the least anti-royal Parliament to sit for a long time. When the king summoned Parliament again in late 1640, the people elected the most anti-royal Parliament in English history. It would sit in one form or another for almost 20 years and become known as the Long Parliament, and then the Rump Parliament, and finally the Bare Bones Parliament. There were a lot of Puritans in the Long Parliament, and with their arrival at the seat of power in England, emigration to New England slowed to a trickle. Indeed, more than 1,000 New Englanders returned to England in the next few years, both because they were no longer afraid of persecution and they wanted to pitch in on the side of Parliament in the conflict, soon to be war, with a crown. Hugh Peter, one of the leading ministers of New England and erstwhile bane of Anne Hutchinson and Roger Williams, was among them. As long-standing and attentive listeners know, Peter would try to prevent Williams from obtaining a charter for Rhode Island in 1644, but Williams outmaneuvered him. We bring up Hugh Peter because, well, things would not go well for him. As happens with most true revolutions, early reasonable demands for reform are quickly overtaken by more radical people, usually those who took the most risk in the revolt. So it was with the Long Parliament, quoting Bancroft. Its earliest acts were worthy of all praise. The liberties of the people were recovered and strengthened by appropriate safeguards. The arbitrary courts of High Commission and the Court of Wards were broken up. The Star Chamber, doubly hated by the aristocracy as ever a great eclipse to the whole nobility, was with one voice abolished. The administration of justice was rescued from the paramount influence of the crown, and taxation, except by consent, was forbidden. The principle of the writ of habeas corpus was introduced. It would become a specific right in the American federal constitution 130 years later. And the Kingdom of England was lifted out of the bondage of feudalism by a series of reforms, which were afterwards renewed, and which, when successfully embodied among the statutes, were esteemed above Magna Carta itself. These measures were national, were adopted almost without opposition, and received the nearly unanimous assent of the nation. Public opinion was the ally of the Parliament. But an act declaring that the Parliament should neither be prorogued nor dissolved unless with its own consent had also been proposed and urged with pertinacity till it received the royal concurrence. Parliament, in its turn, subverted the Constitution by establishing its own paramount authority and making itself virtually irresponsible to its constituents. It was evident a parliamentary despotism would ensue. The English government was substantially changed in a manner injurious to the power of the executive and still more dangerous to the freedom of the people. The king, insofar as he opposed the measure, was the friend of popular liberty. The passage of the act placed the people of England, not less than the king, at the mercy of the parliament. Back to me. Bancroft's take that Parliament, by insisting that it could not be dismissed with its own consent, had set itself up to rule tyrannically, makes sense when you think about the implications. If Parliament cannot be dismissed, then there would be no opportunity for holding new elections. The members of the Long Parliament who did not die and were not expelled would sit in their seats without facing a vote for the better part of 20 years. By 1642, the radicals in the Long Parliament passed a remonstrance, a manifesto denouncing the king and his practices in terms designed to whip up popular sentiment against him. Their margin of victory was a mere 11 votes in a body of more than 500 members, so the radicals were still not dominant. But then Charles blockheadedly overplayed his hand. He marched to the House of Commons with more than 400 soldiers to arrest the leaders of the radicals, which even moderate members viewed as an intolerable infringement on the prerogatives of Parliament. The five leaders escaped. All London was outraged, and the uproar quickly spread to other parts of the country. Charles left the city for the north, assembled an army, and in August 1642 raised his standard at Nottingham. This was how a king declared war in those days, and Charles did so against his own subjects. Parliament had not been idle during those months. It had organized its own army and invested in the defenses of towns that supported it all over England. 2 weeks after Charles declared war, Robert Devereux, the Earl of Essex, marched north with a parliamentary army of more than 10,000, positioning itself between London and the king's men. The first inconclusive fighting came in October 1642. The war itself involved a great many ins and outs and what have yous, and for a while there was a decent chance that the crown's supporters, cavaliers they were called, as alumni of the University of Virginia well know, would prevail. They mostly won the battles of 1643. The forces of Parliament fared better the next year, winning a decisive battle at Marston Moor, just west of York. Then in 1645, Parliament passed legislation to establish an army on a new model. The new model army, uniformed in red coats, had 14,400 infantry, with two musketeers for every pikeman, 6,600 cavalry, and 1,000 dragoons. Dragoons were mounted infantry, using horses for mobility but fighting on foot. Its chaplain was Hugh Peter. The commander of the infantry was 32-year-old Thomas Fairfax. The commander of the cavalry was a member of Parliament named Oliver Cromwell. Here's how Healy describes him, quote, "Born in 1599, he was in his mid-40s, with an ungainly face, fierce blue eyes, and a hot temper. He was known for promoting comrades for talent rather than social position. I had rather, he once wrote, have a plain, russet-coated captain that knows what he fights for and loves what he knows than that which you call a gentleman and is nothing else." He himself was, as he put it, by birth a gentleman, living neither in any considerable height nor yet in obscurity, although his wife, Elizabeth Bourchier, came from a wealthy Essex family. After a brief spell at Cambridge, young Cromwell had suffered severe melancholy in his late 20s. Come the 1630s, he was a farmer, and his income had fallen to around £100 a year. By that time, he'd also experienced a Calvinist conversion, bringing a belief that he was one of the elect. His views at this point were probably those of a country Puritan, fiercely anti-Laudian and anti-Catholic. But in the course of a war in which he tramped the country as part of a disciplined force of cavalry Ironsides, His views moved strongly towards independency, and he was developing a deep distrust in the idea that state officers should force religious practices on the people. Back to me. The New Model Army was the ancestor of today's professional armies. It instilled discipline, trained relentlessly, and had a draconian code against drunkards and blasphemers. It banished plundering, the ancient motive and prerogative of soldiers everywhere, on penalty of death, and made up for it by paying the soldiers regularly. The New Model Army became the most potent fighting force in Europe and rolled up victory after victory against the Royalists, with Cromwell the deciding factor more than once. In May 1646, his army shattered. Charles sought refuge with the Scots, who turned him over to the English Parliament, which took him into custody. He was not tossed in the Tower or the Clink, but placed under house arrest in a palace with hundreds of rooms, the ultimate gilded cage. He was free to correspond, but he was not free to leave. By the summer of 1646, with Charles confined, there were four factions in England. There were, of course, the defeated Royalists, who were now scattered and decidedly unorganized. On the victorious side, there were, quote, Presbyterians and so-called Independents, plus the New Model Army, which increasingly had its own agenda. Presbyterians were essentially conservative reformers. They expected to establish a new and more limited monarchy, a national church, and a supportive nobility. The aristocrats and the moneyed interests were mostly Presbyterians. The Independents, who included Cromwell and much of the army, were truly radical because they wanted to rebuild English society on the principle of equality. Now let's go to Bancroft's characterization of the Presbyterians and the Independents, not because it's precisely accurate, but because it describes the perspective of the leading American historian of the 19th century, which is in itself interesting. Quote, "The majority was with the Presbyterians, who were elated with a sure hope of a triumph. They represented a powerful portion of the aristocracy of England. They had, besides a majority in the Commons, the exclusive possession of the House of Lords. They held the command of the army. They had numerous and active adherents among the clergy. The English people favored them. Scotland, which had been so efficient in all that had thus far been done, was devoted to their interests, and they hoped for a compromise with their sovereign. They envied the success of tyranny more than they abhorred its principles. Monarchy, with Presbyterianism as the religion of state, was their purpose, and they were at all times prepared to make peace with the king, if he would but consent to that revolution in the church which they desired." And what counterpoise could be offered by the Independents? How could they hope for superior influence when it could be gained only by rising above the commons, the peers, the commanders of the army, all Scotland, and the mass of the English people? They had no omen of success, but the tendency of revolutions, the enthusiasm of new opinions, and the inclination of the human mind to push principles to their remoter consequences. I love that line. An amalgamation with the Presbyterians would have implied subjection. Power could be gained only by that progress in innovations which would drive the Presbyterians into opposition. The Independents, sharing in the agitation of the public mind, made the new ideas the support of their zeal and the basis of their party. They gradually became the advocates of religious liberty and the power of the people. Their eyes were turned towards democratic institutions and the glorious vision of emancipating the commons of England from feudal oppression, from intellectual servitude, and from a long aristocracy of supervision inflamed them with a zeal which would not be rebuked by the inconsistency of their schemes with the opinions, habits, and institutions of the nation. The Presbyterian nobility, who'd struggled for their privileges against royal power, were unwilling that innovation could go so far as to impair their rank or diminish their grandeur. The Independents, as new men who had their fortunes still to make, were prepared not only to subvert the throne, but to contend for equality against privilege. The Presbyterian Earl of Manchester, said Cromwell, shall be content with being no more than plain Montague. The men who broke away from the forms of society and venerated nothing but truth, others who, in the folly of their pride, claimed for their opinions the sanctity and the rights of truth, they who sighed for a more equal diffusion of social benefits, the friends of entire liberty of conscience, the friends of a reform in the law and a diminution of the profits of the lawyers, the men like Milton and Sidney, whose imagination delighted in pictures of Roman liberty, of Spartan virtue, the less educated, who indulged in visions of a restoration of that happy Anglo-Saxon system which had been invented in the woods in days of Anglo-Saxon simplicity, the Republicans, the Levelers, the Fanatics, all ranged themselves on the side of the new ideas. The true representative of the better principles of the Independents was Henry Vane, but the acknowledged leader of the party was Oliver Cromwell. Back to me. Longstanding and attentive listeners will remember that Henry Vane had been the first real aristocrat in New England and had been elected governor of Massachusetts Bay on his arrival there 15 years before the victory of Parliament in the First Civil War. He'd fallen in with Anne Hutchinson and had left New England after he was thrown out of office when John Winthrop, Hugh Peter, and others organized her banishment. We will see more of him before this episode is over. We've also seen how Roger Williams, who'd been in London seeking a charter for his own colony during the First Civil War, had befriended and quite possibly helped radicalize John Milton. Not only would the English Civil Wars be felt in North America, the new Americans helped shape English politics in the aftermath of those wars. Simplifying a bit, the base of power for the Presbyterian faction was the Parliament, and the Independents dominated the New Model Army, whose revolutionary fervor had carried the day against the forces of the Crown. Just as Parliament had asserted that it could not be dissolved without its consent, so the army refused to be disbanded. The soldiers positioned themselves to be the actual representatives of the will of the people, and in any case was now the only constraint on the unlimited power of a parliament that would not willingly stand for new elections. The two parties on the winning side of the First Civil War, the Presbyterians and the Independents, were headed toward a second civil war just a couple of years after finishing the first one. Charles saw an opening. The Presbyterians could negotiate with him because they were ultimately looking to reestablish a monarchy and aristocracy. Perhaps he could help them solve their problem, which is that the Independents had an army and they did not. The Independents could not negotiate with Charles because they were keen on wiping out the old class differences and ushering in a republic. Charles had nothing he could give them, and they had nothing to give him. The king and the Presbyterians became natural allies against the Independents. At some point, Charles escaped his gilded cage, probably with the help of Presbyterians who were now making league with him against the Independents. There was only one place for Charles to raise an army that stood a chance against Cromwell, and that was Scotland, where there were always plenty of men spoiling for a fight. The Scots were Presbyterian through and through and agreed to invade England with the purpose of restoring Charles in return for concrete ecclesiastical reforms that they had long pursued and had hoped to get from Parliament. So it was that in the summer of 1648, the second English Civil War began, this time pitting the Presbyterians, the Scots, and scattered English royalists against the Independents and Oliver Cromwell's fearsome New Model Army. Oliver's army is here to stay. Oliver's army are on their way. And I would rather be anywhere else but today. Suffice it to say that by the end of 1648, the Independents and Oliver's army defeated the Scots and Charles Stuart and the Royalists. Since many of the Royalists had been released after the First Civil War upon swearing an oath that they would not again take up arms, The winning independents were far harsher in victory the second time, executing key leaders and again taking Charles prisoner. The army, which had borne the bloody burden of war, had now become radicalized and became alarmed that Parliament went back to negotiating with Charles. In December, the army took over Parliament, arresting 45 Presbyterians and blocking another 145 members from entering the chamber. The remaining 75 members, around 15% of the original total, formed the so-called Rump Parliament, and under orders from the army set up the High Court of Justice to try Charles Stuart for treason. In January 1649, 59 commissioners, known as judges, tried Charles under procedurally dubious circumstances. He was not even allowed to speak in his own defense, convicted him of high treason, and ordered that he be executed. There being no opportunity for appellate review, the date for the regicide by execution was set for January 30th. More than 10 years later, when the Stuarts would be restored under King Charles II, the surviving judges would be hunted down and imprisoned or executed. Three of them would flee to New Haven, and their story will be featured in a forthcoming episode of this podcast on the history of that colony. Robert Morris recently wrote a page-turning historical novel, Act of Oblivion, about the hunt for the three who had fled to New England, link in the show notes, etc. and so forth, which describes the execution of Charles I through the eyes of a fictional character, Richard Naylor. Quoting Morris now, this is harsh, so if you have little kids listening along, you may want to pause the podcast now and resume when they are out of earshot. 1 o'clock came and went. And then, just before 2, there was activity. The window opened, and through it poured a file of soldiers with their officers, followed by the executioner and his assistant, clad in long black woolen coats and black leggings, their faces covered by black masks, with grotesque, ill-fitting gray wigs and false beards. The shorter of them carried an axe, its long shaft resting on his broad shoulder. A bishop appeared behind him with a prayer book open. The king stepped out of the window last, a slight figure, bareheaded, scarcely 5 feet 3 inches, though he carried himself, as he always did, even in these final minutes, as if he were a giant. He went straight for the low block, and it was clear he was remonstrating with the officers at this affront to his dignity, that he should have to lie on his stomach to be killed. They looked at each other, shook their heads. The king turned his back on them. Producing a small piece of paper from beneath his cloak, he stepped to the front of the scaffold. He surveyed the soldiers, the cavalry, and the crowd beyond them. He seemed to realize his words wouldn't carry, so returned to the middle of the platform and read his speech to the officers. Naylor could not hear a word of it, although by the following day it was printed and available to buy on half the streets in London. If I would have given way to an arbitrary way, for to have all laws changed according to the power of the sword, I needed not to have come here. And therefore I tell you, and I pray it be not laid to your charge, that I am the martyr of the people. The king unfastened his cloak and removed it, took off his jacket and handed it to the bishop along with some glittering decoration. He stood in his white shirt in the freezing cold and gathered up his long hair into a cap. He did not tremble. He said something to the executioner and gestured again to the block in protest and then shrugged, got down to his knees and lay full length, adjusting his neck on the block until it was comfortable. He stretched his arms out behind him. The executioner braced his legs apart and lifted the axe as far as he could swing it behind his shoulder. A few moments passed. Then the king made a gesture with his hands, a graceful flick, as if he were about to launch himself into a dive, and the blade descended with such force that in the silence the sound of the blow could be heard all the way down Whitehall. Blood jetted out of the severed torso. The nearest soldiers twisted aside to avoid the flow until it settled into a steady glug, like an upended barrel. The executioner, still holding the axe, picked up the head by the hair, strode to the front, and showed the king's face to the crowd. He shouted something, but his words were lost in the great roar that rose from the spectators, a mingling of exultation, horror, and dismay. Part of the crowd pushed forward through the distracted pikemen, who had turned to watch the spectacle, and darted between the cavalry. Beneath the platform, the blood was seeping between the planks. It pattered in the kind of heavy droplets that herald the beginning of a storm. Back to me. It would be 11 years before England again had a king. The Puritans, as the most cohesive of the independents, would be in charge, and when news reached Massachusetts that Charles had been executed, the new English would, by and large, thank God in his glory for it. Maryland and Virginia, where royalists outnumbered Puritans and other independents by some margin, would have a very different reaction. But that's another story, which I hope to get to in fairly short order, unless my muse intervenes and that kind of stuff. The rump parliament behaved as victorious revolutionaries usually do. It overplayed its hand. It abolished the peerage, no more House of Lords, and severed the connection between church and state. It was no longer an established church, just as there would never be in the United States. But there also would be no republic, because the revolutionaries did not have public opinion on their side, and they knew it. The rump parliament was opposed by royalists, Catholics, Presbyterians, ideological Republicans, and radicals alike, surviving large landholders, and the Scots. Unlike the American experience in the 1770s, it was insufficient diffusion of Republican political theory among the great masses of the English people to set up new institutions. Cromwell, his army, and the rump became just another autocracy. When Charles Stuart's son declared himself King Charles II in absentia, a counter-revolution formed in Scotland and Ireland, and the Third English Civil War was on. Charles II recruited mercenaries in Norway and Presbyterians in Scotland and invaded England from the north. Catholics in Ireland revolted. Once again, the combination of Oliver Cromwell's military brilliance and the new model army prevailed, however brutally. By the end of 1651, after a series of victories in England and Scotland and a brutal massacre in Ireland, Charles II escaped to France. Oliver Cromwell was now in complete control and was declared Lord Protector of the new Commonwealth of England. The problem was, there was no legitimacy in Cromwell's rule. Bancroft summarizes the fundamental constitutional problem, quote, "When the forces of the insurgents had been beaten down, there remained but two powers in the state, the Long Parliament and the army. To submit to a military despotism was inconsistent with the genius of the people of England. And yet the Long Parliament, now containing but a fraction of its original members, could not be recognized as the rightful sovereign of the country and possessed only the shadow of executive power. Public confidence rested on Cromwell alone. The few true Republicans had no party in the nation. A dissolution of the Parliament would have led to anarchy. A reconciliation with Charles II, whose father had just been executed, was impossible. A standing army, it was plausibly argued, was required to be balanced by a standing parliament. And the House of Commons, the mother of the Commonwealth, insisted in nursing the institutions which it had established. But the public mind reasoned differently. The virtual power rested with the army. Men dreaded confusion and sighed for peace. And they were pleased with the retributive justice that the Parliament, which had destroyed the English king, should itself be subverted by one of its members. Thus the attempt at absolute monarchy on the part of Charles I yielded to a constitutional, true English Parliament. The control of Parliament passed from the constitutional royalists to the Presbyterians, the representatives of a part of the aristocracy opposed to episcopacy. From the Presbyterians to the independents, the enthusiasts real or pretended for popular liberty, And, now that the course of the revolution had outstripped public opinion, a powerful reaction gave the supreme authority to Cromwell. Sovereignty had escaped from the king to Parliament, from the Parliament to the Commons, from the Commons to the army, and from the army to its successful commander. Each revolution was a natural and necessary consequence of its predecessor. Back to me. After a decade of religious turmoil and intermittent civil war, in which perhaps 4% of the population had died and many of the survivors had been impoverished, the people of England, now exhausted and hankering for stability above all, put their faith in Cromwell, and Cromwell alone. For some few years, the Commonwealth of England thrived under Cromwell's dictatorship. There was religious peace. Under Charles, England's navy had become immensely powerful, and the English economy boomed under the free trade it afforded. The Commonwealth went after the Spanish and the West Indies and conquered Jamaica in 1655. It would remain a British possession for 307 years. Cromwell pushed the French out of Nova Scotia for good. The powerful Dutch, who went to war with England in 1652, were beaten soundly. The settlement of that war secured Connecticut and all of eastern Long Island for the English, among other things. Being a practical politician more concerned with his own survival than revolutionary principles, Cromwell restored the upper house of Parliament and packed it with newly ennobled peers from moneyed interests who had survived the wars. He was offered the crown, which he declined, concluding that he already had more power than any English king of the age. And yet, the fundamental problem of legitimacy, or the lack thereof, remained. In 1658, after only 6 years of domestic peace, Oliver Cromwell became sick and died in September. He had, as any actual king would do, named his son Richard as his successor. But Richard was not like his father. He did not have the talent or the inclination to rule, and would step down the following year and go on to live a long and peaceful life outside of politics, making it all the way to 1712. Since the Commonwealth had no established mechanism for orderly succession in the executive, civil instability once again loomed. Every faction that had opposed the dynasty of the Stuarts in the 1640s had failed to establish a stable system of government. The conditions were perfect for the restoration of the Stuarts if only there were a mechanism for doing so. One of Cromwell's old generals, George Monk, commander of the army in Scotland, became that instrumentality. Quoting now from Jonathan Healy. The son of a relatively poor Devon gentleman, the fourth child of 10, no less, Monk was a bluff, coarse infantryman who had risen through talent and hard work. He was 57 years old and had been a soldier for 47. He'd fought against Spain for England, France and the Dutch Republic, before fighting for Charles I against Parliament, and then, after a moderate spell in the Tower, for Cromwell in Ireland, Scotland, and the high seas. He loved tobacco and pots of ale, and found it resoundingly funny when people referred to his wife, Anne, who'd once done the laundry for him when he was in the Tower, as Dirty Bessie. Appropriately, he traced his ancestry to a bastard son of the warlike Yorkist King Edward IV. Those who knew him thought him honest and quite lacking in guile. Oliver Cromwell, who fancied himself as a good judge of character, liked to think of Monk as plain-hearted George. Back to me. Cromwell, and many others, were wrong. Monk was thoughtful, opinionated, a patriot, and held his cards close. Back to Healy, quote, in Scotland, General Monk watched. In October 1659, he wrote to the army leaders, deploring their course of action and demanding that Parliament be recalled. Despite a life spent almost entirely in arms, he thought soldiers should stick to fighting. Politics should be left to civilians. His aim was to reduce the military power in obedience to the civil. Preparing for a showdown, he purged his army of officers he thought likely to be disloyal to him, not to the Commonwealth. Then he began moving his men to the Anglo-Scottish border, setting up headquarters at Coldstream on the Tweed on December 8th. Back to me. The political crisis accelerated in London. Soldiers shot rioters. Factions of the English military mobilized. Violence spread through England as various factions, including religious dissidents of one sort or another, jostled for local control. The fleet sailed into the Thames, signaling support for Monk. Monk marched south, and opposition to him crumbled. By Groundhog Day 1660, not that anyone called it that then, Monk's army arrived in London, having scarcely fired a shot. By the end of the month, the power vacuum had become untenable. People everywhere wanted an actual government. The small and illegitimate parliament, such as it was on the ropes. A huge crowd gathered around a bonfire in front of Parliament and chanted, "God bless King Charles II." By the end of March, Parliament finally, fatefully, dissolved itself. Elections were held. Monk finally got in touch with the exiled Charles II, long derided as the pretender, but also now the only legitimate leader amidst the chaos. Charles moved his headquarters to Breda on the Dutch coast. The new Parliament, complete with a House of Lords, met on April 25th. It was overwhelmingly royalist. On May 1st, a declaration from Charles was read in Parliament. It offered a pardon for everyone who swore allegiance to him within 40 days, promised liberty of conscience, authorized Parliament to resolve disputes over property resulting from the civil wars in the Commonwealth, and, critically, assured that Monk's army would be paid and retained under the new regime. That afternoon, Parliament voted that, quote, "the government is and ought to be by King, Lords, and Commons. The Stuarts were to be restored." Now back to Healy, quote, "The month of May 1660 would be remembered as one of the most joyous in English history. The return of Charles, brought back by Monk's fleet, was celebrated with maypoles, church bells, and bonfires. From his landing at Dover on the 25th to his entrance to London on the 29th, the restored king was met by cheering crowds. Some 120,000 were said to have greeted him at Blackheath. In London, his entourage took 7 hours to pass through. The streets became a kaleidoscope of tapestries and flowers. There were fountains flowing with wine. Oliver Cromwell was burned in effigy on a Westminster bonfire. After the austerity of the Puritan Republic, it was time for a riotous celebration." Back to me. The aftermath might have been very ugly, but Charles II knew that moderation and victory would secure his reign. Charles was, by his nature, a fun-loving ladies' man, a forgiving and kindly king, and not inclined to revenge, notwithstanding the execution of his father and his own long exile. Other royalists, including in Parliament, were quite the opposite. The result was a compromise of sorts, a bill of indemnity and oblivion. As Charles had promised in his declaration, the vast majority of people who had taken up arms or served in the Long Parliament were pardoned after swearing allegiance to him. But not all. 33 men were identified for punishment. The surviving men who'd signed the warrant ordering the execution of Charles I and a few others, including Hugh Peter, too eloquent a spokesman for the Puritans to be left alive, were singled out for punishment. Some were hung, castrated, and eviscerated while breathing their last, and drawn and quartered. Oliver Cromwell was exhumed, his now moldering body dragged through the streets. The hunt for the regicides was on, a story we will return to. Finally, in the spring of 1662, Henry Vane, the principal champion of liberty of conscience, defender of Anne Hutchinson, an uncompromising spokesman for the common man, was executed. George Bancroft described Vane's life and death beautifully, if not romantically. Quote, "Now that all England was carried away with eagerness for monarchy, Sir Henry Vane, the former governor of Massachusetts, the benefactor of Rhode Island, the ever-faithful friend of New England, adhered with undaunted firmness to the glorious cause of popular liberty. And shunned by every man who courted the returning monarch, he became noted for his most Catholic, meaning universal, unpopularity. He fell from the affections of the English people when the English people fell from the jealous care of their liberties. He had ever been incorrupt and disinterested, merciful and liberal. When Unitarianism was persecuted, not as a sect, but as a blasphemy, Vane interceded for its advocate, pleaded for the liberty of Quakers imprisoned for their opinions. As a legislator, he demanded justice on behalf of the Roman Catholics. When the Presbyterians, though his adversaries, were forcibly excluded from the House of Commons, he also absented himself. When the monarchy was overthrown and a commonwealth attempted, Vane reluctantly filled a seat in the council and resumed his place as a legislator. Amidst the floating wrecks of the English Constitution, he clung to the existing Parliament as the only fragment on which it was possible to rescue English liberty. His energy gave to the English Navy its efficient organization. If England could cope with Holland on the sea, the glory of preparation is Vane's. He steadily resisted the usurpation of Cromwell, as he had a right to esteem the sorrows of his country his private sorrows. He declared it no small grief that the evil and wretched principles of absolute monarchy should be revived by men professing godliness. And Cromwell, unable to intimidate him, confined him to Carisbrook Castle. Both Cromwell and Vane were unsuccessful statesmen. The first desired to secure the government of England to his family. The other, to vindicate it for the people. Back to me. Vane was brought to trial and stood by his principles to the last. "Who," cried the prosecutor, "will dare to speak for you, unless you can call down from the gibbet the heads of your fellow traitors?" "I stand single," said Vane. "Yet being thus left alone, I'm not afraid, in this great presence, to bear my witness to the glorious cause, nor to seal it with my blood." And steadfastly refusing to abandon his almost astonishingly modern principles, Vane enraged his enemies in Parliament and was condemned to death. He stood equally fearless before his execution, and with it the bloodlust of the vengeful was sated. The death of Vane was not so popular as his prosecutors in Parliament hoped it would be, and mostly marked the end of the new government's retribution. King Charles II put his brother, the Duke of York, in charge of the powerful navy, and in 2 short years, York would capture New Amsterdam without firing a shot. George Monk would become the Duke of Albemarle, and so we have the name for Albemarle County, Virginia, home of the University of Virginia Cavaliers. Wahoo wah. Opinion in English North America was profoundly divided. Puritan New England was the last English place that dreaded the restoration of the Stuarts, and with good reason. Maryland and Virginia, where royalists had long dominated over much smaller Puritan populations, rejoiced. We will explore the significance of both in the episodes to come. Thank you again for listening to the History of the Americans podcast. Your emails have been very encouraging. Please keep them coming. You can reach me with questions, corrections, eruptions of indignation, or pats on the back on the contact page for the website, thehistoryoftheamericans.com, or by email at thehistoryoftheamericans@gmail.com. And please do me the great favor of giving the podcast a 5-star rating on Apple and following me on X for cranky musings on mostly history-related matters. Until next time.